Gary told me I should get up here or Danny won't quit speaking. Yeah, so my name's Adam. I came here about 20 years ago. I came as a student at Hebrew U. Met Gary. Also heard about this congregation before I got to Jerusalem, and I really liked what I heard, and even knew before I got here that this was where I wanted to be. I'll tell you a little bit of a story about how I met Gary. I had volunteered at the Baptist Village for about a month before I came to live in Jerusalem, and Gary was familiar with all the Baptist people, and so I had seen pictures of him. There wasn't Facebook back then. And so I knew where it was. I heard about him. So on the first day of school, first day of classes, we go, and I see Gary. He kind of stands out. I walk up to him and say, hi. Hi, Gary. And he looks at me kind of funny. And then Matt, who's the cop's son-in-law, just starts dying laughing. Because only in Jerusalem do you have this thing where somebody who's never seen you before comes up and addresses you by your first name. And it's too bad I wasn't ready for it. I could have given him like a word of the Lord and shook him up a bit, but I didn't. Shook him up later. Okay, Daniel, I said a little bit about what I used to do at Narcisse, but I volunteered here on the weekends. So I used to clean the floor, set up the chairs. Then I moved on to the sound and did that for a while. And I think you still got that. No, it's a different one. It's the same board. No, it's a different one. Did that break? Oh, it's covered up. People hated that thing. It's like one of the first digital boards in Israel. I'm serious. For some reason, the four congregations here went and got this crazy sound system. And nobody knew how to figure it out, so people were like really cursing it all the time. And then somebody stole it one weekend, and I think people were like, yes. Stole it. And no, actually, we pray that God would convict them, and that's actually what happened. This young kid who took it brought it back because God had convicted him. So that may have had something to do with it, right? That may have had something to do with it, that's for sure. Yeah, so sound, I did the youth. I specifically remember hanging out with the kind of the young people back then, and we went somewhere to eat or something, and Sharona Kopp started talking to me, and then I realized halfway through our conversation that it was basically like an interview of like, who are you? Why do you want to come work with our youth? Kind of thing. And I think I passed the interview. Worked with the youth about seven years. I think we were part of this. I was a part of this conversation for about seven congregation for about 7 years. Then I was later part of the pastoral committee. You guys still meet on Friday mornings? Something like that. Well, we'd meet on Friday mornings and discuss church stuff. I taught the Bible study a couple times, at least once. I remember, but I think maybe more than that. I led worship a couple times. One of the times was kind of interesting. Had some interesting comments after the service. A good friend of ours who I think is, she's probably still here when she's in the country, so I won't name her, but she comes to me and told me, you need to get, what do they call the thing that keeps the timing? Yeah. And I was like, the funny thing was I intentionally tried to slow the song down, but she didn't catch on. And she's a much better musician than I am, so obviously it wasn't her fault. And then there was a sweet couple, Sally and who'd she marry? John. Yeah, from the Anglican school. And they're full of sweetness and probably never said a bad thing or bad thought about anybody. They come up to me later and said, we really like the song she chose. I just thought, that's the worst thing to say to somebody who just led worship, you know, like, we didn't enjoy the worship, but we liked the song she chose. Like, we'll go home and listen to them how they're supposed to be. And thank you for reminding us those songs. I did the sermon once, I think. This will be the second time. Maybe the last. Just kidding. And you know, something, when you give a sermon, I think this happened to anybody. I don't think it just happened to me. Somebody will always hear something that you didn't say. So I had a conversation with this guy about something I totally didn't say, and then I tried to explain to him I totally didn't say it. And it doesn't matter. Here I had his mind made up that that's what I said. So, I have a lot of memories here. Like I said, I was here for 7 years cleaning the floor on Friday afternoons most of the time. Gave me unique opportunity to be in this room by myself. Not more than once I tried to take a nap up here on the stage. I really like that idea. I think, you know, I want to have a Samuel experience. Inani. But seriously, there's something very holy about taking a nap on the stage in a church if you ever get a chance. I highly recommend it. Through this church, I met first Muslim that had come to faith that I met, and that was quite an amazing experience. It was right when I had started coming here, and the cops were still trying to feel out who I was. Gary was a little bit more open, because we're kind of from the same neck of the woods, so he was trusting me. So I heard that they were going to go visit this congregation in Ramallah. I said, "Oh man, I want to go." So I kind of got Gary to kind of convince Chuck and Danny to let me go, even though they were a little bit like, "Who is this guy?" This is the first time I've grown a beard since then, but I had this crazy beard and my hair was like this, taking a Nazarite vow the first year I was here. So they didn't know what to do with me. They didn't know if I had Jerusalem syndrome or all that kind of stuff. But I remember going there with, I know Chuck, Danny, and Gary, maybe there's somebody else, I don't remember. But I just remember the smile on this one guy's face. And I'll never forget it. It was a guy who had gone through physical persecution for his faith. But the smile on his face was just radiant. And I still remember that church. The pastor was a funny guy. He was a Palestinian who had grown up in Alabama. So, you know, my Arabic's not great. I don't know how his Arabic was. But when he would turn to me and speak to me in English, he had this strong Alabama and Southern drawl that I was just not expecting. One of the times he spoke in this, he's quite a character. One of the times he spoke in this congregation, he referred to Danny as the real Slim Shady. You remember that? I remember we had complaints about the neighbors because our music was too loud and they couldn't understand how in a church we're supposed to just pray and not, you know, sing with drums and guitar and everything that we had going on. Different speakers I remember coming here. We used to say you never know what you're going to get at Narkees when you come. And I remember this one guy came who was, I think he was a leader of a seminary, a small denomination, and he brought a lot of his students with him. And all I remember about, I think his sermon, the main part of his sermon was just smile. Just smile. He would, you know, go to that all the time. That was his sermon, just smile. And all the students were like writing it down. And we're looking at each other like, what are they writing down? Just smile, just smile, just smile. And the other question was, why do you want to write that down? But anyway. I also had some guy, I think it was a bit of a cultish figure. He came in, I was doing the sound. We used to do the sound over there. That thing didn't exist. And they came in to kick us out of the sound booth. So that, you remember that? I don't remember that guy's name. Anyway. But then we had some amazing people here that had, I would say, partnerships or connections with the congregation for years. We had a pastor from Sri Lanka that came. At one point, Gary and some others, Brian, Dan, you didn't go, did you? Went to Sri Lanka to visit them there. One of the most memorable speakers that I can remember that was here was Father Thomas from El Paso, Mexico, I think. He worked with people that lived in the trash dumps in Juarez, Mexico. And that was really, really amazing, his testimony. And also we you know, heard about what they were doing even before they got here and just challenging us collectively and personally in our faith. When Gary asked me to speak, one of the first things that came to my mind, other than all these memories, was what does Narkees mean to me? And have a lot of friends in this congregation, a lot of friends who used to be in this congregation. I know some of you were here before me, and some of you are coming back for a visit. Some of you have come since I've been here. Maybe you've been here longer than I was. But really, I think truly my best friends, my real friends, the ones that really understand me, I know from this congregation. I don't know if that's because we were all 20-somethings together, studying together, forming our theology, our worldview together, and so really they're the only ones that understand me. Some of you are smiling because you know what I'm talking about. And also I met my best friend here, and that's my wife, almost 20 years ago, and we didn't like each other the first year here. Took a while to get used to one another, and then we became friends, and then from that we got married. As I say, four kids later, yeah, we're still here. You know what, we even dedicated our oldest daughter. The new carpet, but I think it's the same stage up here. And I want to share with you a few more things about this congregation and why I liked it, why I love what you're doing. But before I do that, I need to tell you why I'm not here anymore if I love it so much. And that's because I married good Jewish girl, local Israeli girl, and we just felt that when we started having kids, we wanted our kids to grow up in, I quote, more Israeli, more local congregation, where their friends from congregation wouldn't change out every few years. And I know that's a challenge for some of you. Some of you can't do anything about that. But that's something that we saw, and we said, you know, we don't want to do that. We also wanted our kids to grow up thinking that it was normal to be an Israeli believer. And we thought we should find a Hebrew-speaking congregation to do that. And so that's what we did. That's what we're doing, still trying to do. There are really two main things when I think about this congregation, two things that stand out to me that make it important to me. One of those things is the desire or the search or that combination, the symbiotic combination of scholarship and worship in this congregation. You don't find that very often. I think on a world scale, you don't find that very often. And I think it's something very special. And when I say scholarship, I don't only mean those that study at Hebrew U and those that doctorates from certain other places. That's important, and I think that's an important part of this congregation. But I really, when I say scholarship, I'm really talking about that search for truth. That we study the Scripture, and we try not to let our traditions or theology that we grew up with dictate what that Scripture means. I work with an organization now called Precept Ministries, and that's what we do is inductive Bible study. So the whole thing is letting the text speak to you and studying the text and trying to see what God is saying as much as you can without the lenses of your theological background, which is pretty much impossible, but I think we have to try no matter. And that other thing is the worship, freedom of worship that I think has always been here in this congregation. My job has always felt there was a freedom here. I know when stories, I don't know personally, but when Liz was playing here in her high heels and everything, and I think she said, if anyone ever tells me how I dress, says anything about the dress, I'm gone. This is a long time ago. And nobody ever did, right? And I think there's a freedom, not really in external appearances here, but a freedom and expression of worship. I think probably just because we're from so many different backgrounds and people have different expressions of worship, and you come here to worship together, and I don't know if they still do it, but there used to be people dance around the back and banners and other people, you know, doing other things here. And that was cool. Most of us, at least for me, I grew up not seeing a lot of that. I grew up with the church I grew up in, and that's what I knew, and that's what I was used to. And Narkis really was part of that eye-opening experience of God just saying there's more and there's freedom in worship, and it's not stand up, sit down. And if you want to raise your hands, raise your hands. It doesn't matter what the person next to you is doing. Another very important thing, and I think, you know, I think Narkis and that with that first issue of that combination of scholarship and worship, I think Narkis can really be a light globally to the body of Messiah, because I think there needs to be more of that globally. But this next part, it can also be globally, but I think it needs to be more local, at least originally. You know, the first one needs to be originally local as well. But that's your perspective here of Arab and Jewish brothers. Unfortunately, since I've been here, the situation in the country has gotten worse politically. And that doesn't leave the body of Messiah in this country unaffected by any means. Both Jewish believers and Arab Christians are trying to identify with the people they live in, and sometimes what they live with, that they grow up with. They both want to be accepted. And unfortunately, sometimes that means that they both take on the prejudices and even sometimes the hatred of their peoples towards the other peoples. Now, of course, that's not always true, but I always felt that this congregation really had the middle road on that, and really saw both people as God's people and sought to minister to both, to have both minister to them, meaning Arab brothers in this pulpit, Jewish brothers in this pulpit, and an openness. I'd like to connect what I've been talking about to the parasha today. And like Jim has said, Jacob and Esau coming to the end of their saga. And you think about Jacob, and yes, he did, it seems, get right with the Lord, but he really had a life of deception, a life of deceiving others, and a life of being deceived himself. You know, even in this week's parasha, he deceives Esau in a, not necessarily in a bad way, he's trying to save his family, but he splits the camps in hopes of deceiving what he thinks his twin brother is going to do to him. And like Jim said, in the middle, he had the story of Dinah that you kind of makes you wonder, what in the world is that doing in there? And next week we have a similar story in the middle of the parasha, and you go, what does this have to do with it? And you know the story with Dinah. You have the same, this thing of deception continuing with Jacob's sons. Shechem, which is Hamor's son, sees Dinah, rapes her. Then he realized, wow, I really like this girl. I think I want to marry her. And since his father talked to Jacob, Jacob's son, see him, they work out the deal first, apparently, from what I could tell. And, of course, you know the story. They say, okay, if you want to live with us, you have to circumcise yourself. And they say, all right, we'll do it. And then 3 days later, it says when the men were sore and in pain, Shimon and Levi go into Shem and they slaughter all the males and take everything they have. And then, you know, what's interesting, I'm glad that you referenced Jacob getting right with the Lord, because Jacob's reaction here is not one of, oh, good, you did, you know, kind of what I did when I was growing up. But he says to them, You've brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I will be destroyed, I and both my household. And he's saying I, he's talking about, he's basically saying us, we. But then they said to him, of course, you know, should we let them treat our sister like a prostitute? The story between Jacob and Esau, they struggled in the womb. Jacob and Rebekah trick Isaac, stealing Esau's blessing of the firstborn, which is basically like stealing his inheritance. Genesis 31, talked about last week, I'm sure Jacob has a disagreement with Laban. And then the end of the saga that we read this week or heard about this week, as they meet and part their separate ways. But figuratively speaking, it's really the beginning of a saga, because today Jacob represents Israel, represents the Jewish people. Esau, along with Ishmael, and Esau married Ishmael's daughter, represents the Arab people. So we really had this struggle just starting. And it's kind of funny, when I was praying and thinking about what I was going to speak about this week and looking at the parasha and seeing Jacob there, I turn on the radio and there's a song by this Israeli kind of heavy metal group called Orphaned Land. And they've got this song called Brother, and it's about their singing as Jacob asking forgiveness from Esau. I thought about playing it for you, Dave, but I thought, no, neighbors probably wouldn't like that too much. But then I thought, okay, God, I think you want me to talk about that. And then as I began to think about that relationship, and I thought about my time here and the people that I knew here, and I thought about how Jesus treated other people, what happened to Jesus when he was definitely said he was called to the lost sheep of Israel, but he encountered non-Jews in his way, and how did he treat them? And I want to read one. I've got a few passages that came to mind, but one seemed to connect more with this week and this parasha than the others, and that's John 4. If you want to follow along with me, I'm really literally going to read most of the chapter. If you are following, I have the English Standard Version in front of me. But now when Jesus learned that the Pharisees, verse 1, had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he left Judah and departed for Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. And he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near that field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Now, what I read in the commentaries, and I'd be interested what you think about this, Yoni, is that they basically think Sychar is Shechem. No? You say no? You don't think so? But is that where Jacob's well is today, or... Yeah, okay. Well, it's still enough for me to tie it to the parasha. Because also these same scholars think that the verses from the parasha in Genesis 33, 18 through 20, is right at the end of Dinah's, the saga with Dinah. Jacob buys some land near Shechem. And some people that I read, some commentators, think that that's where this happened. I thought it was kind of a cool connection to the parasha. Whether or not Yoni agrees with me or not, that's a different story. 6. Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well, and it was about the sixth hour. A woman from Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink," for his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me as a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you water, given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks from this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. The woman said to him, Sir, give me this water so that I will be thirsty, so I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water. And you know a lot of the rest of the story. Jesus says, go call your husband and come to her. The woman answers, I have no husband. Jesus says, you're right. You have five, and the one you have now is not your husband. And at 19, she says to him, Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. Jesus said to her, Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now is here, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. And then the woman has a confession. I know that you are the Messiah. When he comes, he will tell us all things. And then probably one of the most obvious, not confessions, but statements of Jesus being the Messiah is here, I think, when he says, I who speak to you am he. And you know the story. They marveled at what she said. Disciples come back, have this discussion about food. And at the end, verse 39, many Samaritans from that town believed in him, in Jesus, because of the woman's testimony. He told me all that I ever did. So when the Samaritans came, they asked him to stay with them, and he stayed there 2 days. And many more believed because of his word. They said to the woman, It's no longer because of what you said that we believe, we have heard ourselves. And we know that this is indeed the Savior of the world. I thought about how that passage relates to those things that I hold special for Narcisse. We have here Jesus telling the Samaritan woman that true worshipers worship God in spirit and truth. And it's a little difficult to find out what he's really talking about. If it didn't have the preceding verses and he said truth, and I would say he's talking to a Samaritan woman, he's probably talking about Jerusalem. It's probably a locational, geographical, maybe political statement he's saying to her, but the text right before that, he says, Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. But the hour is coming and now is when true worshipers worship the Father in spirit and truth. And I think he's probably talking about himself. Of course, we know other verses when he refers to himself as the way, the truth, and the life. And worshiping in spirit and not just offering sacrifices. But my experience with this congregation also, I felt, was like worshiping God in spirit and truth. In spirit for me, because it was that freedom that I really hadn't experienced growing up and was able to experience more of it here. In truth, because of that scholarship, searching for truth. And like I said, I don't mean that you have to be technically a scholar. We can all search for truth in our daily walk with the Lord. The bigger picture hanging over this passage and also connecting to what I said earlier, the political situation, to me, I see a lot of resemblance between Jews and Samaritans of Jesus' time and Jews and Palestinians today, even geographically. Jesus coming from Judah, coming from Jerusalem, wants to go back to Nazareth or Capernaum. And the easiest way is, the straight line leads near Shechem, leads near what's called Nablus today, near Ramallah. And if you're Jewish, you really don't want to go that way today. And I think probably in Jesus' time, they probably didn't want to go that way much either. But Jesus spent there 2 days. And it said many believed him. Many believed in him. And I don't know what all you do here. But when I was here, we had a lot of people that were here for not permanently, but for a long time, working, some working with Jewish people, maybe even more working with Arab people. And I think Jesus' words are really, really alive and can speak to us today about our calling in this land. Because you may feel called and you may know beyond the shadow of a doubt that God calls you to Jewish people. You know, maybe you may know beyond the shadow of a doubt that God called you to the Arab people. But if Jesus was called to the lost sheep of Israel and he was ministering to those that were not, I would say to you and your ministry, how can you refuse those others that may not be to the people you called to, you were thought you were called to, or you were called to? A couple of other passages come to mind. You know them well. I'm sure you're already thinking of them. Matthew 8, which I had written down here somewhere. Can't find it. I think Matthew 8 is the centurion. Is that right? And you know it. Jesus says, you know, will you come to heal my daughter, or will you heal my daughter? And then basically says, Jesus, I understand authority. You don't even have to come. Just say the word and my daughter will be healed. And then a servant comes and tells him that at that hour his daughter was healed. And Jesus responds to this Gentile Roman centurion, you know, I haven't found faith like this in Israel. And then the Canaanite woman, I think it's Matthew 25. She just asked for the crumbs of the table. Jesus didn't go there to serve her. He didn't go there to minister. He didn't go there to call to her. But she begged. And he did not ignore her. And I think that's a message for a lot of us today. My ministry that I do is mostly with Jews, but we're trying also to get into Arabic-speaking congregations. And I found just with talking to my Arab brothers and sisters that there's a lot that I don't understand, that even at the beginning it makes me upset. To hear that how they see Israel, how they understand God's plan for Israel is not what I believe, is not what I understand. But the more I speak with them, the less I'm upset at them, if that makes sense. It doesn't mean I think they're right, but I can listen to them. I can understand them, or try to understand them. You know, there's one guy who used to come here quite a bit when I was here and would speak, and he was I would say American, but actually wasn't really from America. I think he was from Puerto Rico or somewhere. Where? Was he from New York City? Were his parents from Puerto Rico? Yeah, okay. And he married an American Jewish woman, and they still live in a settlement today. And I think he's a pastor of a Messianic congregation there. But he would have these amazing stories about how he would minister to Palestinians. And some of that ministry was done when he was doing his reserve duty in his army uniform with an army jeep. The political situation was a little bit better then. But he would have these amazing stories about sharing the gospel with these Palestinians while he's in an Israeli uniform. And then, you know, if that weren't enough, he would bring the Palestinians with him, and then they would give their testimony. And I think this, he kind of embodies what I think God is saying to us who live in this land, who are pulled in between these conflicts. Like, you might be a settler, you might be the enemy. Even the left of the Israeli side think that the settlers are the enemy, but it doesn't mean God can't use you to bring Palestinians to him. It might be a little bit harder in our eyes, but it doesn't mean it can't be done. So I want to leave you with that challenge. Some of you may be students here. You may think, oh, I'm not really a minister. I'm a student. But I would say, no, you are a ministry. And God is using you in that wherever you are. You might be surrounded by internationals. You might think God is using you with internationals. And you know what? He may be, but there also might be locals that he's going to use you with as well. So I would challenge you and myself, and really the body of Messiah in this land, both Jew and Arab, to look at Jesus and to think if he ministered to those that he wasn't called for, and I would dare to say that he knew his calling better than any of us did, then let us not close our eyes to those who we don't think we were called to. Oh, thank you.